I can't believe how many people are in pants. It's my first time in Phoenix ever, and I about died this afternoon. My name's John. I'm an alcoholic. I sobered up August 29th, 1985, and that's incredible to me. I got 60 days, and I was sober longer than I'd ever been before. And I didn't want to be here, man. All I brought in here was a bad attitude and a desire to find a way to drink safely. And I just wanted to get out of the trouble I was in. I was had a lot of people after me on the street, and a lot of detectives looking to have a talk with me about some felonies I'd been involved with, and I just wanted to get the hell out of where I was at. So I ran to treatment for a little while. I was going to cool out, let things settle down on the street, and then try to keep going and get it back up again. It didn't work out that way, man. You people were too cool to me, and I started to like it in AA, which was the last thing I thought was going to happen. I grew up in one of those homes where I learned to drink and drug at a really early age. That was pretty much what was going on in my house. There wasn't a whole lot of parental supervision. And, the first time I ever smoked pot, I was 6 years old, and the first time I ever got suspended from school for possession, I was 11. And by that time, it was an everyday part of my life. I drank or drugged or whatever in the hell was around from pretty much as early as I can remember. As long as I played baseball, I was doing drugs and drinking. It was just the way it worked where I came from. That's what you did. That's what the people around me were doing, and that's how you got attention. So that's what I did. My family, my mom and dad split up when I was like 6 or something like that. And all I remember was that, you know, there wasn't any structure, there wasn't any schedule, there was always people hanging around all hours of the night and sleeping all day, and police were coming by, and I guess, you know, you learn to live with what you got, and that was what was normal to me. So, you know, it kind of, the transition took place from my brothers and my parents being the ones that were, you know, the knocks at the door were coming for, and then pretty soon it was me. And, you know, I found out about police stations and stuff like that when I was maybe 12 or 13, and, you know, I was, they wouldn't take me in the military when I was like 20 because I had a juvenile record. And, it was just one of those things. Maybe it wasn't supposed to go or whatever. I was really disappointed at the time, but maybe it wasn't what I was really looking for. I moved in with my dad. We first went with my mom after the divorce, and things got crazy. And one by one, my brothers left and went over to my dad's. My mom got remarried when I was 7, and she married a tyrant of a drunk, and I kind of got this fear about drinking because of what was going on when I was 8 or 9. They'd start drinking at whatever time, 5, 6 o'clock in the evening, and it was just kind of dangerous around my house. And so I'd kind of just try to not be seen, you know, just kind of hide out somewhere, not get attention, and just stay out of the way because things were going to start flying, and if I was around, I knew it was all going to kind of get focused on me. And so, you know, I saw what booze did to people, and I was afraid of that. And, you know, the people that I was exposed to that were doing drugs, you know, they didn't seem to get violent and yelling at me and stuff like that. And so it was kind of more my thing before I got to be, you know, a teenager, to just kind of stick with the drug scene, because that was, you know, a little easier to deal with for me. But I'll never forget when I learned how to drink, because the first few times I drank, I puked my guts out, and, you know, I got busted, and I stunk for days or whatever, and, you know, it just was a bad experience all around. Things got broken. I felt like out of control, and that's just because I drank like a pig right from the beginning. I think my first real drink was when I was 7 years old. Somebody was babysitting for somebody's parents. I don't know what the situation was, but they were throwing a kegger. You know, what else would you do? And somebody handed me a quart of beer and challenged me to drink the whole thing. And I don't know if I was able, actually successful at that, but I do know that a lot of people paid attention to me and I got put to bed early. And that, you know, that was one of the early drinking experiences that didn't go all that well, because I do remember feeling really sick and it just didn't work out too well. I remember my brother putting me to bed and kissing me on the forehead and saying, you know, just go to sleep, man, it'll be all better in the morning. And that happened again. A friend of mine came over when I was like 11 and he had stolen a fifth from somebody, and we just started pounding that stuff at 11 o'clock in the morning. And the next thing I know, I was waking up and my dad was shaking me saying, what the hell did you do? So I seemed to find trouble really quick when I drank, and it just didn't work out that well for me. So I kind of, like I said, stuck around the drugs for a while. But one of my dad, see, there's a real difference between living with mom and living with dad for me. Dad is the only member of my immediate family who does not seem to be afflicted with this disease. I've seen him drink a half a glass of wine and not think about it, and that's a foreign idea to me. He did so much to try to get me out of the trouble I was in. It was, my life was nothing but chaos by the time I moved in with him, and I was 11 or something. It was at his house where I got suspended for possession, and, you know, by the time he started to notice, which was right about then, that kind of made him think that I might be getting into some stuff he didn't want me doing. By the time he started to notice what I was doing, it was so much entrenched in me. It was what I did. My life was just revolving around being a pothead, smoking dope all day long, skipping class, whatever. It was what it was all about for me. I had a paper route and whatever and bought dope with it. So he started to look for solutions to my alcoholism. And he didn't have any idea that I suffered from an obsession of the mind. And, you know, that... it's, for me, there's a difference between my drug use and my alcoholism. I have the obsession of mind about all of it, and the thing that differentiates my alcoholism for me, I don't know about anybody else, is that, you know, I would sit there and smoke my stuff and whatever, trip on acid, snort cocaine, eat mushrooms, whatever, and there was a limit to, you know, what I needed. Whatever, smoke a certain amount and I've had enough. I never, ever in my life had enough to drink. Not my whole life do I remember saying, you know, that's it for me, you guys finish the rest. It wasn't in my vocabulary. Eventually he got to the idea that boarding school would be a good idea. And he sent me off to... He threw me a book one day and said, you know, here's a ton of schools in here, you pick one, I'll send you to it. Because what had happened was I was just a chaotic figure in anybody's life who I came into contact with. You know, they describe the alcoholic as like a tornado whirling through the lives of others. And, you know, that was me. That's a good description. I find a lot of real good descriptions of me in our book. And my stepmother had a progressive fatal illness. She suffered from MS, and she kind of needed a peaceful, calm atmosphere in the home, and I wasn't really conducive to that. When I went back to live with my dad after several trips back and forth, he only had one rule. He'd given up on trying to control my alcoholism, and he said, the only thing I really need from you anymore, John, is to just be home at 10:30 at night. And that right there was a real problem, because I didn't get up until like 1 in the afternoon, and I generally wasn't going to, you know, and that was if I got home by 3. And it was a part of my lifestyle, so I don't think I followed that rule one time that summer, and my dad wanted to do anything he could do for me, so he sent me off to school. And, you get down to one of these schools and they hand you a rule book, right? And the first thing, you know, I flip to the page that talks about drug use, and it says, you're expelled. And then I find the part about booze, and it says you got to work 8 hours for the first offense. But I didn't read past there. And I thought, oh, I can do that. So, you know, for a while, for a couple of months, and I think that's the time when I achieved pretty close to 60 days of continuous sobriety was my first 2 months down at boarding school. You know, I tried to keep it clean. I tried to stick with, you know, not doing anything. You know, I felt kind of like an obligation to my dad. He'd spent a lot of cash to send me down here, and you know, I didn't want to screw it up. I knew he you know, I kind of had some kind of desire to do the right thing at that point, because whatever, I'd been off the stuff for a week. But it kind of went away. I got around other guys who were trying to do the same thing, of course. I mean, we find each other. It's there's some kind of connection we all share that, you know, I can recognize another alcoholic, and I just gravitate toward them, you know. So we go off to Thanksgiving, and somebody had a condo, and there was an old bottle of, like, peach, I don't know, it was half full, and it was really nasty, man, but we had to drink it. And my buddy couldn't drink much of it, and he started puking, and that's probably because he was smart. You know, it was really bad stuff. But I drank the whole thing, and it really wasn't near enough to do the job, but it was plenty enough to get me back into the scene again. And what happened was, like, we'd get to go out for the weekends a couple hours every night and whatever. And so me and him, the next week, we head over to the liquor store, and we start hanging out in front trying to find somebody to buy for us. And, you know, eventually you're going to find somebody. And we went out and drank a six-pack. You know, that didn't do it either. And so the next time it was a 12-pack. And pretty soon I had that first offense, and, you know, pretty soon I was thrown out of that place. Didn't take long. Now, I was trying hard for a little while, but as soon as I started again, all that stuff was over, and I was looking for why everybody else was wrong, and I was right, and, you know, pretty soon they told me to hit the highway. So, he sent me to another school, and I got thrown out of there, too, and that was the end of it for my dad. I finally worn him out. There was an interesting development a couple of years earlier when I left my mom's house for the first time. Like 4 months went by, and all of a sudden my mom started picking me up for weekends and saying, yeah, well, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm like, really? It wasn't any news to me, but it was really, it was interesting that she started saying that. And obviously, we know what that is. She sobered up. And, you know, she was attending AA meetings, and it was the biggest part of her life, and all of a sudden, you know, I got the house to myself for a couple hours a night when I was visiting her, and you know what I did with that. But, so what happened was when she threw me out, that was the end of it. She almost got a divorce behind it. That wasn't an option anymore. And so when I got kicked out of my last boarding school, my dad said, you know, I don't know what to tell you. I've done everything I can do for you, and there's, you know, maybe $180 in the account down. And I was in South Florida. I was in Miami. And I don't think I mentioned it. I grew up in the Detroit area, so I was 1,500 miles from home. And so there was my option, you know, stay in South Florida and drink this $180, or, you know, spend 80 of it on a bus ticket and get back up north and drink. And that's really kind of as far as I thought the whole thing out. And I just went back to hook up with my old buddies and live on the street and figure something out. I had a big plan about how it was all going to go, and I was going to get a job, and, you know, we were going to get a place together, and we were going to, you know, I was finally going to drink like a free man. Because that was like the last obstacle to my drinking. You know, finally there wasn't going to be any more dad or mom breathing down my neck, and I was going to be able to drink like I always wanted to and do whatever in the hell I wanted to do. It was like April of 85, and I had made a little trip to a treatment center the previous summer to get out of another felony count, and it worked. And the joke on the street was I was, and I don't know what happened because nobody ever got in any trouble behind it, and I was known as the only guy who ever did any time behind that deal. That, you know, it was funny and all. And I remember going that last summer I was out there, we would joke about how one day AA was probably going to be a big part of our lives. And, it was hilarious. But I remember plenty of times going out deliberately to get hammered, you know, and they would describe, you know, the whole chain of what takes place when you're going to go out and relapse, and I was like all about it, man. I couldn't wait. it was bad. I had, basically, it's as simple as this. I didn't have a desire to stop drinking. My desire to drink outweighed my desire not to drink, and that's all it took. You know, I wanted to get wasted. I wasn't done. And so, I spent the summer on the street. I never quite got around to saving enough money to get that apartment. And any job I could get, I really kind of couldn't quite get there after 6 or 7 days. And I lived from one scam to the next, you know. Yeah, I was sitting out here tonight listening to Kip, and that guy is an incredible story. And I sat there feeling really grateful because a lot of the childhood experiences he described, they were just like mine. And God decided to intervene in my life a hell of a lot earlier than he did in his. And, and he was talking about sitting in that parking lot in the 7-Eleven. When I was, about a month and a half of getting sober, I walk into this convenience store, and I probably hadn't changed my clothes in 5 days, and I stunk, and, you know, I was just trying to pull a scam, go in there and rip something off, I don't know. But there was a kid I went to high school with, man, and I turned the other way. I hope you didn't recognize me. And I guess, you know, that's one of those memories that sticks with me because that's really kind of where it took me. I couldn't even see people that I'd grown up with anymore. I didn't want them to see me. I knew I looked like shit. I knew I smelled like it too, and I just didn't want to be seen in my present state. So it was interesting to me that he described, you know, a lot of experiences like that, and, what I was going to come to in the next couple of months was people that were in their late 20s, early 30s who were describing the exact same early childhood experiences who went on to describe hooking and spending a lot of time in prison and, you know, just living on the street day to day, you know, on to the next getting wasted experience, whatever it was, and that's really what their life was about, and there was all kinds of bad consequences coming their way that, you know, bodies permanently scarred and, you know, injured, whatever. A lot of people I sobered up with don't have any veins left. You know, there's no circulation. It's kind of funny. I'm sitting in treatment, right, and there's these people in their late 20s rubbing my arms because I got good veins. And they're like, man, if I had these veins, I wouldn't be here today. I don't ever want to say that to somebody, man. I don't want that experience. I don't know what, you know, why God saw fit to intervene in my life when he did, but I'm sure grateful because my life has pretty much been a scream ever since. You know, I sat out there the last few months and I didn't do much except screw everybody over in sight. Anybody who turned their back on me, I burned, and that stuff caught up with me. The only stable place I lived was on a couch in the living room of a dope house, and I lasted there about 7 weeks, and I was 6 weeks behind in rent, $25 a week, and we had this kegger or something on my 18th birthday, which was 4 days before my sobriety date. And this guy passed out, and so we rolled him. I mean, that's just what we did. It's how we were. You know, that dumb son of a bitch shouldn't have rolled up, you know, and passed out in front of us. So we took his money and went out partying. And that guy happened to be the wrong kind of guy to mess with. And the consequences started looking pretty grim for me over the next couple of days. And the long and short of it is, you know, I got tossed out of a dope house, and I got asked to leave in not real friendly terms. And there were some real serious threats sent my way, and I believed them. I still believe them to this day. You know, I was told really clearly that, you know, they're going to let me walk out of there that night, but don't let them see me around there the next day. And you know, the police were going to catch up on him, because a lot of stuff came out right then about, you know, my good buddy that I spent that summer with kind of living in his car, and it always smelled like booze. And what we do a lot of times is kind of line up the car outside the 7-Eleven. And I was the guy who was fast enough and ballsy enough to run into the store, grab a case of beer, run out, and jump in the car, and he'd speed away. And this was like a regular thing for us. And I never got caught doing that, but we spilled a lot of beer in there, and it was pretty much my home. And so we went over to his house one day, and he wasn't home, so we robbed the place. And kind of guy I was. I told somebody, though, because I'm really smart. And that was one of the things that brought this culmination of events, and that there were some detectives in that town who had become interested in that case. And yeah, I had a little history of these little robberies, and they'd have been more than happy to have me removed from their daily life of problems. That one more degenerate off the street was the way they'd have looked at it. So, you know, I was willing to cooperate with that, and I left town. And I went to treatment, and, you know, I remember 3 days after I got there, one of these detectives was on the phone, and the guy who let me in treatment, and there's just some intervention involved in that. You're supposed to, the place I went, you're supposed to call every Monday between 10 and 11 in the morning, and every Wednesday between 1 and 2 in the afternoon. And I guess the theory is if you can keep up with that, you know, you're kind of willing, you know, for 6 or 7 weeks. And what happened with me is I cried for help one day, and I was in there 6 hours later. And it's just because I had family and the fellowship and friends that ran the place. And so, but 3 days into it, this guy was on the phone, and he says, you know, I need you to tell me who else was involved in this. And I said, you know, what do I look like, a snitch? And the guy who's running the treatment center said, you can go get your stuff right now and get the hell out of here. Because what you just said really is that you're not willing. And I got a lot of people on the waiting list. You know, people are dying to get in here, and if you're not obviously taking this seriously, so hit the road. And I said, well, where would I go? So I ratted everybody out. This kind of guy I was. And you know, what happened to me is I walked into this place, 18 years and 4 days old, and I really did believe that I could have kept it going. What I needed was a change of circumstances and surroundings, and I needed, you know, the world to kind of ease up on me. You know, they wouldn't give me a break. And, you know, I really wasn't all that bad of a guy if you were watching me. But, you know, it kind of, I remember one real, really important incident. It seems really simple, but when I was checking into the place, they kept all my stuff because they had to search it, you know, make sure I didn't bring any dope in there, sneak a bottle in there or whatever, and they had my cigarettes. And so I'm sitting out there just fiending, man, and this chick walks by and said, you got a cigarette? And she said, yeah, sure, and handed me one. And I'm like, you're not going to ask me to pay you or nothing? That's what I was used to. I was used to people who didn't give away anything for nothing, and they didn't trust you, and they rightfully so didn't trust me. And, you know, it was kind of a simple, kind gesture that I've come to just learn to live with, because that's what my life is based on today. You know, it's been a part of my life ever since. It goes both ways. I got people in my life who give me anything and do anything for me, and I got a ton of them out there that I do the same for. I don't know how you get from where I was when I walked in here to sitting up here tonight. Got flown from Denver. You know, it's really nice to have friends because that's how you get to speak at conferences without giving up tapes. If y'all had got a hold of my tape, I think that somebody else would have been speaking here tonight. Anyway, You know, the place I went was really hardcore. What we did is mostly cleaned up after farm animals. It was a real farm. And sat 6 hours a day in group reading the big book and talking about these principles and going to meetings every night. And what we had to do also was when we got to the meetings, we had to get phone numbers and we had to get a sponsor and we had to get like 9, 10, 15, 50 people who would take us out on a weekend if we asked them, you know. And so, I mean, it's funny, it's still going on today in Ann Arbor, you know, you're sitting in a meeting and you see the farmers come in and there's like 12 of them and they're like eagle-eyeing everybody who's not their support yet and they're going to go get their number and people are like, oh shit. Because Don Farm has worn Ann Arbor meetings out, I'll tell you that. But it's a good thing because, you know, from the 9 months or so that I was in there, there's probably 60 people who came through the place, and I'll bet 30 of them are still sober today. I can confirm at least 18 of them, and, you know, there's a bunch of other people that were doing real well when they moved on with their life, and they just don't live in Ann Arbor anymore, like me, you know. I've moved. So it kind of grew on me. My life was filled day and night with a bunch of AA. They beat it into me. We read the big book cover to cover like 7 times while I was in there. And the way it worked was there was this farm, that's where you went, and then there was this house in Ann Arbor. The farm was way out in the country in Ipsy, and the house was in Ann Arbor, and it was kind of cool around there. You know, there was a lot of action and that kind of stuff. So the goal was to get to the reentry house, and reentry, they're going to reenter society from there. And so, you know, I got there and I started, you know, I started trying to shoot the angles on how do I get over to this reentry house, and it was really the obsession of my life while I was in there. That was when you really arrived, is when they moved you over to the reentry house. And, you know, there was I think at least 9 people who came in after me who went to the reentry house before me. And it was really starting to grow on me that this was a bummer of a deal. And they finally moved me over. I've been at the farm 6 months, which is twice as long as most people stay there. And I don't know why. I'm not getting this, man, because they're dealing with people in their 30s that have been living on the street for 20 years and whatever. And I didn't think I was all that bad, but they thought I had a bad attitude. And I didn't see that, you know. I still don't see it. Anyway, so I got over there. I achieved my life goal, and they gave me my inventory because that's what they do over there. And that, you know, I was all excited. I'm gonna get my inventory. Well, I'm gonna do this deal, and I said, "Fuck this!" when I got it. And they started to take notice that I was just kind of doing couch time there and kind of hanging around doing my deal and not their deal. And so they had this phrase, they're going to put you on a week, which means you got a week to get your shit together, you can get out the door. And that I looked at as my out date. And so I purposely sat on the couch one more week, and they called me in the office, and I, you know, I understand you haven't done much for a week. And I said, that's about right. And they tossed me out. And so what happened was I moved in with a guy that had just actually completed the program, and he was a good friend of mine. You know, I made a lot of real close friends in there. And I went down to his house, and an hour later, you know, I had a place to live. And an hour after that, I had a job. And, you know, 2 hours later, we were at a meeting, and they needed a coffee maker. And I think, you know, that 4 hours between the time I got kicked out of treatment till I took the coffee commitment at that meeting that night, that's the last time I've ever been unemployed by AA service work. You know, and that was 13 years ago. And I'll tell you what, I've had some really cool service gigs since I've been in here, and I'll tell you a little bit more about those. But one of the things that, you know, so I kind of knew, you know, and that's, I don't know what, how much you can know about staying sober, you know, at 8 months and having never lived outside and have to, like, live a life and go to meetings. You know, I was just pretty sure I could do it. And I did what they told me to do as soon as I got out and whatever. I just followed instructions because my willingness changed the moment they kicked me out of the farm. I don't know why. I just believe God was, you know, doing miracles in my life once again, which is an interesting topic. You know, all that stuff that Kip was saying tonight, you know, and all this crazy stuff he went through and how everything just worked out just like it was supposed to, it don't surprise me a bit. Because I've seen a lot of really crazy situations turned into absolute miracles in people's lives all around me since I've been in here. I do not doubt the power of God. Because I didn't have much willingness at all when I walked in here, and somehow God reached in me and put it there. I don't know why I was willing to stick, because the whole time I was in the farm, the door was open. You just, look, the minute you don't want to be here, please, please go. And that, they said that every day, and I never did it. I wanted to a lot of times. And you know what? One real huge miracle in my life is that I think the last honest desire I've had to go get drunk was like in mid-September of 85. I don't remember wanting to drink since then. Now, I've wanted to do a lot of other things, but I haven't wanted to do it. I've been like sold on this deal and sold on my own alcoholism and that this book describes me since then. And I don't know, a lot of it I'm sure was just fear of what was going to come to me if I went back out. But, you know, I was sitting in this cornfield. We were shucking corn. And I didn't want to shuck no corn. And it was a hot day and I had like $14 in my pocket. And I figured, you know, that's good for a case of beer and a hamburger. And that's as far as I carried the thought. You know, I didn't think about what I was going to do afterwards. And I go to talk to this guy because they say, you know, go talk to somebody about it. Tell us your plan. And so I go to this guy who's been in the farm for 4 months. I say, hey, man, you know, I really want to drink. And I, you know, I've already counted my money and I know how far it can get me and whatever. And he said, let's go. And I knew for, you know, that I better go talk to somebody else. That's the last time I ever really remember wanting to go get hammered. And I'm grateful, man, because that ain't my nature. You know, I think I've described the kind of thinking that dominates me. And, you know, I don't doubt the power of God. So, you know, I'm out of treatment for a little while, and I'm, you know, I'm actually keeping a job this time. I've got an apartment, and I'm up on the rent and everything else. And my mom bought me a car. She was always good at bailing me out. And there's a group shows up in my town, and they want to go bid for the International Conference of Young People in AA. And this is January 1987, and I spent the next 12 years on bid committees. And you know, and there was a guy in the room that night. They brought in a guy from Chicago to come speak, and you know, he was talking about all the great times he'd had with it, you know. And then he said something like, you know, if you're going to get involved with bidding for this thing, it's probably a 5-year deal. You probably bid for 4 years, maybe get it in your 5th year, because we're getting a ton of bids these days and whatever. And the only thing I saw in that was that that was probably 5 years I could stay sober. And so I stuck with it, you know, and Michigan's still bidding. That was 87. you know, so it was cool, you know, but then, you know, a couple months before that, I'd been to the Michigan Conference of Young People in AA, and I got in a room where there were 800 people that were about my age, maybe a few years older, but they were happy. They were excited about being sober, and there was meetings, and there was energy there, man, and it jazzed me up, and it made me want to go to another one. I was ready to go to Ohio, I was ready to go to Indiana, but I didn't know when that gig was, you know, and then we're going to go to Boston, to this really huge one, you know, and I'm like, let's go, man, what can I do? You know, I stood for every position that night, and I didn't get elected to any of them. It was just a really cool thing. Because I didn't care, man, because they said, you know, all the people who got elected said, you know, I need help. And so I went over to like 9 of them, and I joined 9 of the subcommittees. And whatever, I'm a junkie in everything I do. I guess that's getting to be apparent here. So what happened was, like, toward the end of that summer, I got a little story I want to tell about that first bid, because it really changed my life. somewhere around July, I went to one of these meetings that they were having, and there was people there that I thought were just gods, man. They were my gurus, and I was, you know, whatever it is they're doing, it's working, and I'm going to get a piece of what they got. And an interesting transition had obviously taken place in my life, because I really wanted AA by that point. And they said they were going to get this little skit together, and they were going to put people in Michigan costumes, little Michigan-looking things. And there was going to be 8 of them, you know, one for each letter in the word Michigan, and they were going to rewrite some songs, you know, the Motown songs, and write them with AA lyrics, and they were going to... They rewrote the grapevine from heard it through the grapevine to read it in the grapevine. And you know, all I had to do, they gave me the lyrics, they gave me the costumes. I got to find 8 people who are going to be in Boston and get some music without lyrics for this stuff. And, you know, today you can go to any karaoke bar and get that stuff. But for some reason, I couldn't find it. And we got to Boston and I had failed. This whole thing, man. Our whole bid was going down the tube. And there was this guy that had been, one of these big heroes of mine up to that point. And he was going to do the singing, and we were going to do the dancing over here. And there was like it was a room with a railing, I remember that. And we had to come out of a closet in the back of the room and walk around here and get over this edge here. And you know, this is where we're going to do our gig. And, you know, I'm sitting here sweating it, you know, like, hey, I'm the bid's going down, and it's my fault, and I'm, you know, I'd never thought I was a big deal in my life. And anyway, this guy said, don't worry about it. What I'm going to do is go up there, and I'm just going to start clapping and ask everybody else to clap a beat, you know. And I wanted to punch the dude, because that, you know, I thought that was insulting, you know, that's what he thought of my work. And, by the time we got out over here to this rail and I got in my spot, the clapping beat had become so loud that I lost control of my body. I started jumping up and down and just falling my eyes out, and I'm just, God, just reached out to me. And my life's never changed back since. I've been going to AQPI ever since, and I didn't stop crying the rest of the weekend. It was the greatest thing I ever saw. There was like 5,000 people in this room, and they were all the best friends I'd ever had in my life. Something happened there. The fundamental change. That was definitely the most profound single spiritual experience of my life. There was more love in that room than I've ever felt in any one place in my life, and I just want more of it. I keep coming back for, if nothing else, when I'm having the worst times of my life, I can look back on that and say, man, this deal works. Because I got bumps right now thinking about it, man. It was 12 years ago. It's awesome. So about 5 years in, I actually got introduced to the steps. And yeah, I'm one of the people who stayed sober on fellowship for like 6 years. And what happened was, you know, I was chair of the whole bid committee, you know, and there, I was like this big inspirational leader, and I borrowed money from everybody who was following me around. And it was really a bad situation, and none of them really cared too much, but I'll tell you what, I felt like lower than a snake's ass. I did. I really felt really rotten, and there wasn't any booze around to blame it on, and I don't think I've ever been so close to wanting to whack myself. I didn't want to drink, but I didn't want to live another day. And I was getting evicted from my house. My lights were shut off already. The cable was long gone. The phone was gone. And I'd been served with the papers. And all I knew is I read it, and it said the sheriff would come and get me in 30 days. And so I sat in there with no lights and nothing for 30 days and bawled. And about 10 days in, I started writing inventory. For the first time. And something happened. Something happened big. I didn't even have a real sponsor yet. But by that time, you know, I'd been exposed to enough people and I'd read the book enough and I had studied it. You know, I got to reading it and studying it and just decided that whatever it takes, before I walk out that door, before I eat a fucking pistol, I am going to see what AA really is before I give up on it. Because I had never really experienced the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I ever knew was the fellowship to that point. And it was, I'll tell you what, it works for a while, but it's not the solution to alcoholism. The solution to alcoholism is in the book, and it's the only thing that's ever worked for me. I don't know. I'll just say it this way. It's a solution to alcoholism. I don't know if there's another way out there, but I know what's worked for me, and it's the only thing, and it's given me such a cool life. Everything I ever did out there, any dope I ever smoked or drank or snorted or whatever, never got me anywhere near as high as I've been off AA. You know, that's the cool thing. I got a better life than anything I ever imagined before I walked in here, man. I thought I had the deal, and I did think you all were stupid, boring, and glum. And I, you know, that's what I was willing to do when I walked in, just to stay out of prison and stay off bleeding in a gutter. And I found that this is the best deal anybody ever offered me. I just didn't know how to recognize it, you know. So I did that deal. I got a sponsor. I made a commitment to myself that I'd do whatever this guy said. And he told me to do some really goofy things. And, you know, this was like 91. And, you know, I just didn't believe it for a while. And I just did what he said anyway because I knew what my other options were. You know, I was ready to head out the door. And my whole life changed. You know, I kind of drifted away from the young people scene. I graduated. I was going to become a big people's AA. I don't know what happened, but, you know, I go through the steps and I make my amends and I, you know, all kinds of great, seriously, substantive changes took place in my life, and all of a sudden I was a pretty reliable guy, you know, of real use to other people, and, you know, all those things that I thought were for you guys. And the more, you know, other different types of service commitments were coming my way. I mean, like I said, I've never been unemployed by AA since 87, 80, 85. And, but every time I tried to get out and live somewhere else and check out the world and, you know, do some stuff. But part of what kept me there was this idea that one of these days we might actually get to host Icky Pod and, you know, I'm going to stick around and see. And in 95 I went to the world and I was fed up with the deal. And I said to a buddy of mine, look, you know, if we don't get it this time, we'll leave. And we didn't get it, and so we left. And we're rolling down the highway to move to Colorado. We're in Iowa somewhere in a restaurant. He says, let's do Breaky Pot from Colorado. And I thought that was the dumbest idea I'd ever heard. I was so done. And what happened was I was driving the moving van and I took off ahead of those guys the next day to get ahead. Maybe we can make some better time today because this thing would only go 62 miles an hour or something. And they never caught up with me. And I ended up one night in Denver, and I went to this meeting, and I go out to coffee with this guy I've never met before, and he tells me, wow, man, I just moved here from L.A., and I just came from Akipop, man, and it was the greatest thing in the world, and I don't know how you go about getting involved with something like that. And I dropped my face in my hands, and I was like, this is the last guy I wanted to meet tonight. I wanted to go to Breckenridge and ski and be Joe AA member of the 2 Mile High group in Breckenridge, Colorado, and do nothing for AA for a while. And it didn't work out that way. I mean, I called this guy the next day, you know, because I'd made a friend in AA. Hopefully he'll forget all about the young people's thing. And I gave him my number and whatever. And 3 weeks later, he called. I said, I got 30 people, man, and we were all lined up and ready to go. And I called that guy in Arizona you were telling me about. And he's got 60 people, man, and we really want to do this wacky pod thing. And, you know, come on down. So I was unretired once again. And whatever. We ended up throwing in a bid for Icky Pond, getting it. And now I'm still the biggest sellout Michigan's ever known. And I don't know. It's interesting. It's been a great road. This year, you know, I got picked to serve on the council, so I'm in there in D.C. last year voting for Michigan. Hey, what do you do? They had the best bid. At least a couple other people thought so. So since then I've been to, like, I counted them today. I'm on the way to the airport again. Okay. Since D.C., I've been in 10 different cities. None of it's been for business. It's all been for some kind of AA thing. Usually something to do with a bid committee for a pot, or going to a conference or something. It's just been a wild road. I mean, for some reason, God seemed fit to put the financial resources in my life where that's possible and where I don't even have to really think about it, man. I just go and do it, and the cash is there, and the time off is there, and whatever. So I'm on my way to the airport. Oh, what the hell was I going to say? I don't know. I forgot what the hell that was all about. But the thing is, I know what it was. I was going to tell you that I just came back from riding my motorcycle across the country and all around and just having a blast for like 3 weeks. And while I was out there, you know, I ran into like 10 of these really great friends I have that like know me. And I know them, and like we share a lot of stuff, and you know, at least 8 of them are guys. It's just awesome. I mean, my life is so full of good stuff today. My work life, we started a roofing company last year, and I employ 6 members of the fellowship. And they're in my life every day. It's all about one of them, man, scared to death out of me the other day, shot himself in the gut with a nail gun. And hit the one thing in there he didn't need. And there's 9 vital organs right around where he shot himself, and he got his gallbladder. So they just took it out. You're done, go home. And, I wasn't so sure that I hadn't lost this guy. And this is probably one of the 3 most close people that I am to in this world. And he's definitely my adopted brother. I'm closer to him than any of my real brothers. You know, I'm all about Thomas, and I thought he might die 4 days ago, so I don't know, that scared me. But it just kind of brought up to me when Kip was talking about all the tragedy that's been in his life, how lucky I've been. You know, I've never lost a family member. I don't know what that's all about. I'm sticking with that knock on wood thing because I don't want to lose any of them, and I know that'll happen someday. But I don't know. You know, my day's like this. Somebody will come and knock on my door. That's where when I wake up. And it's always a member of the fellowship, and they're looking for what they're going to do that day. I spent a lot of time in AA, you know, trying to get some kind of business going and not being able to pay the bills, and sometimes not being able to pay the people that work for me, and it really put me in some bad spots. One guy that I owed money to for like 6 months is coming to visit me on Tuesday, and he's going to hang out with me for a month. And it's something he's been dreaming about for years. I mean, this is a friend of mine. I don't know, it's just a load of good stuff, and a living amend I get to make every day is that every time somebody comes into my office for a check, I got it. You know, I can pay them. That's a nice feeling. It should be a simple thing, but it's a big deal to me because I've been really financially irresponsible a lot of my life, and today it's not quite that way. So, I don't know. If you're in here and you're new, and I know there's at least 3 of you with less than 30 days, and you know, I got a chance to go to dinner with one of them tonight, and it was, you know, it's neat. It's worth it. I didn't think this deal could work for me. It was great for all of you, but I don't know. Man, I talked for a long time, didn't I? Anyway, it can work for you, just like it worked for me. Stick with it another day, even if you think you got a better deal going. You know, there's some goofy little slogans in AA, stick around 90 days, and if you don't like it, we'll respond to your misery. Whatever works. I don't care what works. Just stick in here, whatever it takes. If you know, some Hazelden stuff or some inner child stuff is what keeps you around, I don't care. Whatever keeps you around, stick around till the miracle happens. Thanks.